If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Notes from a Native Daughter. I am Sol Danela. I am here with Maria Nieto, filmmaker, writer, journalist, an all-around creative worker, someone who is concerned about the Latino voice, the Latina voice, the Latina presence, who we are, how we're out there, how we're not out there, concerns that I also think about constantly. And I asked her to be here, and she came all the way up to the Bronx. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm honored. I am first-generation Colombian-American. My parents came here from Colombia. So for me, I was born and raised here. I'm a born and bred New Yorker. I'm from Flushing, Queens. I'm a Queens girl. But I feel very New Yorkina. It's who I am. So my parents, the way I look at it is I have a right to be here. And my parents made it a very long way to ensure that I felt like a part of this, the fabric of the city. So all of the conversation coming out of the White House to me is an affront. You know, it goes against every one of the founding values of this nation. And you know what? And I always tell people, like, there is an invitation at the base of the Statue of Liberty, and we are RCP'd, yes. So I don't think we can be turned away now.
No. But it's interesting to learn all these stories of, you know, why are we here, right? Because other people might be wondering, why are they there?
Yeah.
How did they get here? It's a legitimate question.
Oh, it's absolutely a legitimate question.
You know?
I mean, yeah, I think it goes in terms of, like, national identity. I think the bigger question is, why did my parents leave? And it's funny because I never really, it's one of those things as a immigrant family, I never occurred to me to ask.
Did you?
I never did. My mom, you know, had a nice family in Barranquilla, in La Costa, and two of her sisters stayed. You know, she and her sister came here. I don't think they were doing very badly off in Colombia. And it's surprising because she came here before she was married. So I think it was really just from a sense of adventure.
Yeah.
And the same thing goes for my father as well. I didn't hear of any, like, hardships and, my God, had we not made it here, I don't know what would have happened to us. No one suffered terribly. But there was this sort of, and especially in the 60s, it was this, maybe to a large extent, it was the promised land. You know, you came here to you know, the roads are paved with gold, you know?
Yeah. Let's start with your love for writing.
You know, it's funny. I never considered myself a writer. I want to say it was about 15 years ago, and I was miserable at this job. Miserable. I mean, miserable. You know, that kind of soul deadening. I was getting anxiety attacks and losing, like, a quarter of my vision from the stress, kind of miserable. And something in my spirit was like, I want to write. And I did. And the last thing I thought I could be was a writer. It seemed like such a lofty goal. Like something.
It is a lofty goal.
Yeah. It is, right? but I had always suffered from crippling low self-esteem. So the very concept of writing is to put your voice out there and to say my opinion matters and I'm going to, you know, put it out into the world and see how it's received. So that seems so alien. I mean, just the thought of, like, even putting something pen to paper seemed really outside my grasp. But I was miserable, so I went up to I used to work by Grand Central. So there, the building, I went up to the rooftop because I liked the view and I liked to clear my head. And I'm like, and I just sort of put it out into the universe. I'd like to be a writer. But I said it with such trepidation, like I'm asking to win the lottery. You know, I'd like to be a writer. And then I wrote an article and it, you know, for a magazine. And then it kind of took off from there. And then I took on more writing at the nonprofit that I worked for at the time, you know, where I left that job. I went into the nonprofit world and I got to do more writing there. And I had an affinity for it. And then about 12 years ago, I'm like, I think I like film. And what if I tried my hand at screenwriting? And that's what I did. But it was always like with a fear and a fire in my belly, like both at the same time. It's just constantly been me sort of saying, I think I want to do this. Terrified. It's never been easy, and it's never been something that I said, sure, Maria, you can do it. You got this. Never.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just, I did a baptism by fire every single time.
Studied journalism at any one point?
I had begun my studies at NYU for journalism. I never finished school. I had a death in my family. My younger sister passed away. And
it changed.
Yeah, it changed.
It changed things.
Yeah, it brings you to your knees in the most profound way, and nothing makes sense. A degree doesn't make sense. Going to school doesn't make sense. Finishing the chapter doesn't make sense. None of it makes sense, you know? You sort of touch the infinite, and everything around you just seems so small and meaningless, you know? And it takes a long time to recalibrate. And you kind of have to, like, on a soul level, make a decision, like, I can't keep floating off into the ether, you know? My family used to tell me, can I speak in Spanish?
Mm-hmm.
So no se puede enterrar con ella. But the desire to kind of go there is so strong.
Yeah.
So I was 19 at the time. It was
very
just
young.
Yeah, very young. I didn't have anything to anchor me, you know. And I came from a very somewhat violent alcoholic family. So it was just an accumulation of things, and I just never went back.
Did you ever write about this loss?
No, I haven't. It's probably it's that little broken wing that I carry with me,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
It took me a long time to even talk about it really publicly. But I think I'm ready to. I keep hearing the message, and I believe in the synchronicity of things. And I keep hearing the message from different people. Like, I think it's time to sort of get that story out there.
Mm.
Because it's profound. And for me, I don't hear anyone talking about sibling loss. You know, and I think it's one of those tragedies that nobody really understands. People understand a mother's loss, a wife's loss, a husband's loss, a child's loss of a parent, but nobody really understands a sibling loss. And it's a profound connection,
mm-hmm.
you know, from cradle to grave. It's supposed to be from cradle to grave.
Right.
They're the ones that understand, they have the same memories as you. They're the ones that, you know, come from the same nest. So to lose that is... It untethers you in a way I don't think people really understand. And it gets very much, you know, be strong for your parents, or you have to be strong for your mom. But nobody really says, like, well, you know, you lost your sister, you lost your brother. My God, that must be, you know, you don't really hear that. So I think it is important to kind of get that story out there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll share, you know, I lost my husband almost 2 years ago. And I think for the first year and a half I was... I don't know, comatose.
Yeah.
Like walking, but
mm-hmm.
making it out in the day, but not really.
Yeah.
You know, I spent a good 6, 7, 8 weeks in my bed.
Mm-hmm.
Mourning is so weird. I really resented people wanting to make me feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
No, yeah. It's this sort of, you don't know where to, there was a live human being that filled your life,
mm-hmm.
you know, that had a full range of emotions, and they're reduced to memories and photographs.
Yeah.
And what do you do with that?
Right.
What do you do with that? You know, how do you fill that void? It's primal.
Yeah. Definitely.
You know, it's everything from like, there was a scent that went along with him that, you know, that he left on the sheets. There was a sound of a voice. There was a feeling that's indescribable, which is, I knew when he was home because the energy was in the apartment or the house, wherever you live, you know? And how do you put into words the loss of that?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's
indescribable. And then the work of a writer is to describe it somehow.
Exactly.
So
how do you go from there and then becoming so, you know, from your point in time when you decide, I want to give this a try and give mm-hmm. myself a chance to be a writer? And how do you bring yourself then to be concerned about how Latinos or Latinas are and are not present in this whole milieu area of
yeah.
entertainment or arts, culture, what have you?
I've always been surrounded by Latinos. That's always been my peer group. That's always been my friendships were all Latinos. So those are the stories that naturally come out of me. And then you start looking around through that lens. When you want to actually get into this industry, you're like, oh, I don't really see a lot of it. And I don't know having not gone to film school and having not really formally trained in this, you just sort of, I remember Calixto Chinchilla and his New York Latino Film Festival, and he sort of provided the narrative. It was incredibly important work that he did. Yeah. It really was incredibly important because he's the person that sort of said, listen, there's a deficit here. Yeah. So much so that we need to have an entire film festival to address it. And so a lot of my understanding of the industry and how we fit into it and didn't fit into it was shaped by what I was hearing from that film festival. And then you start reading up on it and you're like, oh my God. And then you start thinking about, and then it's a lot of it is breaking your own conditioning. Then you start thinking, yeah, there's no one on Friends as Latino. And it kind of breaks the glass and you're like, oh my God, we are a DEFCON 1. We have a situation on our hands. And then it became a matter of, well, we need to change this because I see our stories and I see our humanities. And the richer your life, the more enraging it is that we don't have an outlet for it, that we're reduced to these side characters, the maids or the, you know, the drug dealer or those stereotypical characters. And you're like, no, I'm a human being. I have dreams and visions and goals and desires, and I inform this nation and I inform this conversation, and I'm not represented there, you know. And having also, you know, spent a lot of summers in Colombia when I was a kid, you see what a world looks like where Latino is the norm, and you're like, well, wait a minute, how is it that we go from being the full embodiment of everything possible to now being shuttled off as these side characters? How does that happen? And that's when you start understanding that you're outnumbered mm-hmm. and you're not the ones, you know, you're not the decision makers.
Yeah. And don't you think there's also this disconnect between even our own big TV channels sort of misrepresent us, right?
Yeah.
Sort of, it's very degrading at times and
yeah.
sort of upsetting.
It's incredibly upsetting.
When I see it in these soap operas, I'm like...
You mean the Spanish language?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other thing, too, which you know, everybody says, well, you know, follow the African-American example. I'm like, yeah, you can. And certainly in terms of, like, a infrastructure for a filmmaking community, you should. You know, I think there's a lot to be gained there. But the intricacy of the Latino experience is much more involved because we have that Latin American side and we have the U.S. Latino side, and they're two different things. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're right, because the Latin American side has huge issues with representation themselves. If you were to look at, if you turn on Univision or Telemundo, everybody's like blonde hair and blue eyed, and when did that happen?
Exactly.
You know, the indigenous voice is not there, the African American voice is not there.
Or even in look, you know, like,
right.
We don't see people. Yeah, it's very strange.
It is very strange, and it's not representative at all. And then there's this weird sort of acquiescence to that reality by the televidentes, you know, the viewing audience, where it's almost like, yes, you're right, you know, it's television, the best of us should be represented. I'm like, what do you mean the best of us? You need to question this. Where are the indigenous voices? Mm-hmm. And I keep remembering that Selma Hayek said that she would never, I think, I don't want to misquote her, but I think it was to some extent that she actually came to the U.S. because she knew that with her look, with her dark look, she was never going to reach the heights of telenovela glory in Latin America. So it's this weird sort of, you know, where you can actually come to the U.S. and if you can be that exotic one, you can have a better career here than you can in Latin America.
Hmm. Yeah. Twisted, fucked,
right?
Colonialism,
yeah.
White supremacy shit, right?
Yep.
I mean, it's a paradox.
It is.
In a sense. And I don't know who's going to fix it. So what are some of these stories that compel you that either you have written or you are going to write? Mm-hmm. What are the stories that you see that could be told?
I'm thinking of doing my sister's story, my childhood with her, for a competition for HBO that's coming up. The other stories I'm working on is actually a Latin. It's gonna be in English, but it's gonna be for the Latin American market, for Panama. And it's just a straightforward thriller. I mean, the thing is, my stories are just stories that just happen to be either they take place in a Latino community with Latino people, but that's just because that's who I am. Mm-hmm. And that's my, you know, those, these are my friends, and this is what my world looks like.
Yeah.
You know, but we're still going to, you know, if I'm writing a horror, I'm going to chop you up in the same way. It's not like a Latino chop. Right? That axe is coming down.
Yeah.
Same way. So, you know, I tend to go more into genre. But it'll always be told, you know, through a Latino lens, because that's just who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to be a very mainstream writer. So am I going to tell the immigrant story, like the immigration story, like we traversed the desert? No. First of all, I'm not Mexican, so I can't even begin to touch that story. Y no me nace.
Okay.
You know, it's just no me nace. I'm going to tell you a very New York story of a Queens girl who, you know, loved her sister very much, and we had, you know, summers in Colombia. And it wasn't even like a rich part of Colombia. We were like barrio princesses. And, you know, we had all the kids from the town with like, in a town, the neighborhood, like La Cuadra, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very urban New York story.
Yeah.
And to some extent, it's an urban Colombian story.
Yeah.
So I can't, you know, I can't do like an immigrant story. I'm also not a documentary person. God bless the people that do that work. But that's just not.
That's not who you are.
That's not who I am. I like, you know, I like popcorn movies. will I hopefully do a profound horror movie or a, you know, very revelatory action movie? God willing. But in terms of like saying I want to tell that immigrant story in that way or in that Indie Spirit Award way, that's not going to be me, you know.
And what is the difference, you think, between very mainstream or indie or alternative?
I don't mind the formula. You know, I like escapist fare. And I think you can do really good escapist fare.
Of course.
But I also think there's this sort of art house, deep, very lofty kind of film that you can make, like European films. And I'll be honest, I can barely sit through them, you know, so much less write them.
Yeah.
So I like films that I can see just about everybody in the country going to see because it's horror, because it's a genre film. It's horror or it's sci-fi. But it's done well. A picture like The Matrix, but with Latinos.
Yeah.
That's it. It's about the story and it's about the genre. And it will be with Latinos, but it's not going to be art house for the most part. It's not going to be what a lot of people call like poverty porn. I'm not going to. That's not. Yeah.
That's awful.
I know it is. It's like, God bless, and that story does need to be told.
Mm-hmm.
But I hate to say, I don't see white people constantly exploring Appalachia, you know?
Yeah.
They're not, like, constantly navel-gazing. They know that that's a part of their narrative, but it's not the full embodiment of their narrative. So I want to be the embodiment of other narratives.
You write your own scripts. You read other people's scripts. You co-produce. How do you navigate all these different spaces that you operate in?
Well, that's a good question because it's again, I'm self-taught in everything. Like, self-taught in everything.
I love it.
Yeah, yo me lancé, and I was like, let's figure this out, you know?
Exacto.
Right now I have a writing partner, Leslie Donaldson, and we've written a horror, we've written a dark comedy female buddy film. And we, so we've got those out in the market. Then I'm also doing a project for Panama, for Latin America, and that's on my own. I also have another writing partner called Miguel Garcon, and we're writing more sci-fi. I really have yet to actually pen anything on my own, and I think it will be my sister's story for the HBO contest. And I think it's part of it with me has been sort of like this fear of like, I think it's still a little bit of that, what I experienced up on that rooftop, like, just your own thing, for you sure? And I think the time's come, I'm a good co-writer because I have a good sense of story, and I think this works, that works. I can navigate. I can help other, you know, my co-writer kind of like saying, "Well, this is a good, compelling moment. This is how we should probably travel these tracks." And I think I've done a great job of picking good co-writers. But I think I'm almost at the point where I'm ready to sort of pen something of my own from beginning to end. Con suerte, Dios mío.
One day at a time.
Yeah.
So I love sci-fi. That's my thing. Time travel stuff in there.
You know, one of the ones that we're working on. Yes, it does.
Yes.
It's and it's but actually that's influenced very much by Miguel. Miguel, just his brain works in that way.
Mm.
And because I didn't go through film school where they tell you you have to stick to your genre, I don't stick to genres. I stick to stories. And I consume a lot. So I can do sci-fi or horror. Although, to be honest with you, I don't watch a lot of horror because I'm a scaredy cat. So, like, I literally will say, like, I've not watched a lot of the horror classics because I was like, life is hard enough. I don't, why submit
Freddy
myself?
Freddy Krueger?
Yeah, no, oh my God, he was the worst one.
Yeah, he was bad.
I'm like, I can't go to sleep. Because I think that also was very telling for me because I realized that it's the things that you can actually envision happening that are the most terrifying. Mm. You know, what are the odds of my being at the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, right?
Yeah.
There's certain things.
It's so gross.
But what are the odds of me going to sleep every night? Pretty high.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes. So the sci-fi genre you like, you don't like necessarily?
I do like actually sci-fi.
Okay.
Yeah. The sci-fi I actually really do like. Probably not as like, I'm not a hardcore kind of sci-fi person. Mm-hmm. But I watch enough. Like I watch The Matrix. And I think Miguel also probably is the one guiding that ship. Like, I just saw Arrival, for example. So will I watch it? Yeah, because I like the concept. I like anything that turns traditional thinking on its head.
Yeah.
That makes you question the paradigms around you, the structures around you, and go, what if? That's what I love about sci-fi. The sci-fi, really, what's usually at the heart of it is like, what if? What if this weren't true? What if this is, you know, what if aliens lived among us? What if this is all, you know, a computer, you know, a computer, what do you call it? The Matrix, the computer.
Yeah, the center, the.
Yeah.
The Matrix, the.
The Matrix, yeah. The computer programming and you're stuck inside
software.
Of it. Right, software. What if there's a whole other world that's underneath it? And I think that, to me, is really compelling. And I think it's really important work as well. And it's funny because I'm going to tie that back to my sister's death. It's that same sort of having everything that you thought anchored you, all the sense of identity that you thought you had, getting it ripped away, being completely untethered, is almost like a sci-fi experience. None of it makes sense. And you are almost standing outside the Matrix looking at it going, oh, I see now. We're supposed to sort of get up in the morning and go to work and then, but none of it makes sense anymore.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
It's like you're out of your skin.
You're out of your skin.
Yeah. Like, how do I get back in, or how does the skin come back to me, or something like that?
And I think really good sci-fi, when it's done well, will make you feel like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love sci-fi. And I've been thinking about the new seven planets that were discovered. Mm,
the exoplanets.
Yeah. You know, either I'm amenable to going, or, you know, I think that maybe these people have, you know, they're going to go to one of these planets when they kill us all.
Yeah, I think they have an escape hatch.
I think they have an escape plan that it's not, you know, we're not privy to, you know, at the rate they're going anyway.
Yeah,
I feel, you know, I've been feeling a little apocalyptic lately.
It's hard not to.
You know, it's terrible.
Well, yeah, and also, if you were to believe the scientists, which I do, this isn't like a abstract anymore.
No,
these are legitimate. There is a legitimate doomsday clock,
mm-hmm.
And I think they said we're like 30 seconds away from it. So, but to your point, yeah, these are apocalyptic times.
Yeah,
we're. I keep holding on to that, and again, this is I think the power of cinema and the power of art. I think it's the movie called The Day the Earth Stood Still, and I think it was a robot that said, you know, it's funny thing about humans, it's at the brink that you change.
Yeah.
I'm holding on to that.
We're on some brink, for sure.
Yeah.
I think people are starting to awaken.
Yeah. And I think that's what I'm saying. It's at the brink that we change. And I think now people are starting to understand we're at a brink.
Yeah.
We're going to have to change. What do we have left to lose? I don't know that if I don't write, I die. I just know that it was... I think whatever part of me kept me sane and whole during some very, very dark years, you know, my childhood was not easy. My father really was a violent alcoholic. And my family disintegrated when my sister died. We just disintegrated. So whatever part of me that was that kept me alive then and sort of held on to hope, I think my writing comes from the same place. It's just sort of like this tenacious thing. I'm like, it's only a reed, and the current is tough, but I'm going to hold on to this reed for whatever I can. I have an indomitable will to survive. I have a fight or flight like nobody else's business, and I think my writing comes from that same place. It says, I'm just going to hold on. Yeah. And then it was like, then I'm going to hold on, and then I'm going to, you know, be terrified, but I think I have a voice. And then it's, I'm terrified, and I think I have a voice, and I think I'm going to do it. And then you do it, and then you just put one front in front of the other. And then that's somehow how you walk over coals.
Yeah. And you're going to be in that documentary, The Revolution is Uncomfortable?
Yes.
Tell me about that. I love that. I loved it. I couldn't believe that. I thought it was so beautiful what he's putting together.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it happened because, you know, I sound ridiculous, but it came through Facebook. Mm-hmm. He's a neighbor in Red Hook in Brooklyn, where I live. I moved about 8 years ago. And through my postings on Facebook, he sort of reached out and go, hey, I'm doing this documentary. You know, do you have time? Would you come down? And that's the one thing I will say for myself. You know, if you invite me, I'll show up. Como buena colombiana. I'm like, okay. So he was about 2 blocks away, and I came to his house, and we just had a conversation. And then I loved the kind of questions that, much like you, like the kind of questions that get to the heart of it. It's questions that dig underneath. My personal philosophy when it comes to writing, when it comes to just about everything in life, is what is the psychology behind it? Because I think humans are driven by very primal, you know, fear or anger, just real primal psychology. And that's what he was getting at. And if you start looking at it through those lens, you have really interesting conversations, which I think is what he's doing so incredibly well. Mm-hmm. You know, he looks at it through the prism of his own, you know, rough childhood.
Yeah.
And when you start looking at our nation full of wounded people, then you start understanding why they cling so terribly hard to things that don't make sense, because they don't make sense. But when you see that it's, you know, scared children, completely clueless and just sort of wanting something better or feeling as lost as I think they do, you can understand in a deeper way than I think than just talking policy. And I think that's the brilliance of the project.
Yeah. And why is it called The Revolution
is Uncomfortable?
Because that's a question for him, I suppose. But
well, he explained it a little bit, and it's on his
It's on the GoFundMe page.
It's uncomfortable because it does make you ask, why? Why do I believe the way I do? Why would somebody else believe the way they do? And I mentioned this, actually, he just taped me again for this installment of Revolution is Uncomfortable. I had I have a couple of trolls on Facebook that I engage with every now and then, mostly because they're family friends. And then one of their friends, who's a woman, I think she lives out in the West, I want to say like Arizona, and she's half Latina. And usually we just bash each other, and it's, you know, it's terrible. I'm not proud of it, but you know, you just get so angry. And she actually said to me, she goes, you know, ever since Trump's been elected, I feel optimistic. I get up with like a vigor to go to work. And it wasn't because of the things that we hate him for. It was because somehow she felt validated and her guy won in a way that made her feel motivated. And honestly, Solana, I didn't have the heart to bash anymore. It cracked through my veneer of my ideology. And all I saw was a human being who needed this, who all of a sudden felt and then I just couldn't take it away. I didn't have the heart in me to make it angry. I felt almost like, I don't know how starved you were that this, you know, cracked saltine is your salvation, but Jesus, I can't be the one to come along and snatch it out of your hand now.
Yeah.
But it's conversations like that, and it is uncomfortable. You know, and you have to be willing to say, let your humanity shine through, and I have to lay down my ideology and have a conversation and see her humanity despite the fact that I'm like, oh, you know, what are you doing? And that's what makes it uncomfortable. It challenges everybody.
Yeah.
You know, what pays the bills, honestly, is copywriting. So I'll do people's resumes, or I'm going to help somebody edit a book. But I also do the Latinas Chat Media with Linda Nieves Powell and Sofia Quintero and JF Siri, and which is kind of like another outlet. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that it focuses on Latino representation.
Yeah. I know Linda from way back in the day. I was in her original cast.
Soy Latina.
Yo Soy Latina. I'm talking, this must be 1989, 2000, mm-hmm. when she was doing Yo Soy Latina. And I got this the part of the woman who was getting a divorce. And it was amazing. It's good to hear that you work with Linda. I appreciate her immensely.
Oh, yeah. I'm... They're incredible women.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I mean, the more you start really working within the community, you're like, oh, my God, we're brilliant, you know?
I know. We are.
You know, you're brilliant. They're brilliant. We have so many brilliant, amazing people. And then you start really looking at the industry. And you're like, okay, so what are these barriers to entry? What's really holding us back? And it's funny because I will share the fact that I don't look Latina at first glance. And that's actually enabled me to move in other spaces. And when you start seeing the way one space operates, you're like, okay, I get it now. There's this whole other language, the whole other, like, these cliques that, you know, and we're kind of chasms apart. So you start really looking at how do you disassemble that? How do we get those bridges that are going to help us get across? Because there's art and then there's industry. Mm-hmm. And it really is the business of show. So when they're looking at formulas, we don't fit in. You know, they understand the Mexican block or the Caribbean block. And, you know, and they know just enough to know why it won't work. But they know they need to make it work, but they can't figure out how. So it's complicated. But what I will say is that we have incredible talent. If you notice, the really great artists have no compunction about it reaching. You want to reach as wide an audience because it's that desire to have your voice heard, you know. And the ones that do it really well do it with a sense of, like, humility and sort of like, look, I may not know what I'm doing, but I honestly think I figured something out. So I hope as many people can listen to it. And you can disregard it if you want, but give it a shot, you know. And I think the really great artists come with that sort of humility and sense of, like, I am a servant to you. Yeah.
And you are a servant to whom? Or to what?
To humanity. I you know, not to sound too grandiose, but yeah. I love people. I just do. I think we're all just scared little kids trying to figure it out. And God, if there's anything that I've been through or a story that I can tell you that somehow helps you avoid an ounce of what we've been through, then for God's sakes, let me give it a shot. Because, ¿qué me gano yo? You know, if people around me are miserable or scared, it's like the same thing with that woman that was a Trump voter. I don't want to snatch your cookie, you know? I really don't. I want you to be happy and fulfilled, and I want us to all figure out a way that we can all be happy and fulfilled without kind of like crushing somebody else to do it. And I think it's only by each of us telling our stories and go, here's what I learned, you know? I was over here in this cave, and I came back with this. And maybe if you come back from your cave and we kind of put it together, we might make something. I think that's the best we can do.
Aww. Qué bella.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This has been amazing.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.